All movie violence serves one of two purposes. It either makes you feel good or it makes you feel bad. It's either a punishment or a reward. What is it that shapes our response to violence that we see but can't feel? Broadly speaking, it's a matter of who's giving and receiving the violence. If the white hat cowboy gets shot in the kneecap, we cringe. If the lumbering zombie gets the top of his head chopped off by a helicopter blade, we hoot and holler. Of course, it's more complicated than that. Take, for example, Chinatown. In one swift motion, Jake Giddies almost loses his nose. Since he's the protagonist, we understand this action as punishment. It's his price to pay for sticking his nose where it doesn't belong, and it hurts to watch it. At the same time, there's something exquisite about feeling the violence in our consciousness, but not in our body. We simultaneously feel the pain of the action and the relief that it isn't happening to us. For some, that cognitive dissonance is pleasurable. This dissonance may be at the heart of all storytelling because any emotion can be pleasurable to experience in the safety of our imaginations. Laughter, arousal, happiness, sure, but disgust, shame, and sadness as well. We tell each other stories because we like to explore feelings without consequence. Violence is useful in storytelling because it has an uncanny knack for making us feel. Just as Hollywood will never tire of the girl, nor will it tire of the gun. It just hurts so good. Hello there, and welcome to the Real Radar Podcast. My name is Scott Sipu.
And I'm Justin Rodriguez.
And today's theme is masculinity, marriage, and the transformational power of violence.
God damn.
We approached the show this week kind of interested in talking about violence, but it's sort of a big topic. It's almost like doing a show about love. So we wanted to talk specifically about movies that view violence through the prism of a marriage. Today we're going to be talking about the classic Hollywood action film, some might say the greatest action film of all time,
Die Hard,
from 1988, director John McTiernan, and a movie that we've both been talking about for many years, Straw Dogs.
Yes, Sam Peckinpah's Straw Dogs.
But first, we're going to get into Die Hard. Let's start at the beginning.
So would that be Make Fists with Your Toes?
You want to know the secret to surviving air travel? After you get where you're going, take off your shoes and your socks. Then you walk around on the rug barefoot and make fists with your toes.
That's a great beginning, by the way. That is an excellent way to start a movie. That is not how you think the movie's going to start. And it seems like plausible advice.
I don't know if it's plausible advice at all.
I mean, it works, right? It works for John McClane.
No, it doesn't work for John McClane. It works for John McClane for 30 seconds and he has to run around the movie with no shoes on because
well, it doesn't
of it.
End up working out for him in the long run, but I mean, in most normal cases, there aren't terrorists that are going to take over the Nakatomi Towers.
For John McClane, that's every day.
So, when was the first time you saw Die Hard?
I probably saw it when it first came out on video, like in the 80s when I was a kid.
Yeah, I saw it on VHS too. I think this is the first time I saw it in Letterboxd.
Yeah, I saw it full screen forever because I had a tape of it. I watched it over and over again when I was a kid.
It's got such economical, geographical signifiers placed throughout the whole film. Like, you always know where McClane is.
Well, that's one thing you really saw in 80s movies. You could see the movie making technique in action. Like seeing early Indiana Jones movies, you can kind of see the storyboards if you watch the frames.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Oh, very much. Like, this has that storyboarded look.
It has a storyboarded feel, and it has a well-directed narrative. You know, like he's running through random corridors, but there'll be something there to pay off visually so the audience knows where he is.
Like the nudie picture, right?
Exactly. The first time he just kind of looks at it and keeps walking, and the second time he taps it, he's like, okay,
I know where I am. Yeah, and so does the audience.
Yeah, exactly. It's clarity. And one thing we really lose nowadays with all the fucking shaky cam is how great clear action scenes can be, where you can like distinctively tell which side of the frame the actions are coming from, and you can build a more structured action sequence because of it.
Absolutely. You need geography. You need to know where all the parties are and where he needs to go and what he needs to do and where the obstacles are up in their way. That's what I love about Spielberg action movies and a lot of these 80s action movies. Like, even if you look at sort of like a lesser 80s action movie like Top Gun, you generally have a good idea of where the ship is in relation to the other ships. And that kind of stuff is completely broken down with the enhanced reality editing.
At first, when the shaky cam came in, you know, it kind of amps up the tension. But now you forget how beautiful it is to see an action sequence take place with full clarity.
I think they trafficked a little bit more in suspense than in constant action. It's a suspenseful, satisfying sequence when John McClane is in the boardroom when Mr. Yakamoto is about to get shot by Hans Gruber. It's the fact that we know that he's over here,
and they're over here and they can't see him, but he can see them, that builds the narrative tension. And then once it explodes into violence and now he has to run away, if we didn't understand why he was safe for a moment and now he's not safe anymore, it wouldn't have had that narrative resolution of turning from suspense into excitement at the right moment.
There's always an effective action motivation behind every scene. Fire hose, shoot the glass, under the table, C4, cops are storming the building. There's always a focus to every action sequence, which I think is what makes it constantly fresh. And so was the exposition, I thought. You know, the talk he has with the cabbie on the ride in is just spot on. With that small conversation, you get the whole backstory of his wife.
So, your lady live out here?
About the past 6 months.
Meaning you still live in New York?
You always ask us many questions, Argyle.
That's a good scene because it really is pretty baldly expositional in nature, but they instantly have a nice little rapport. They're both interesting enough that you're learning about their characters. And while you think you're learning about character, you're actually setting up all these little narrative gags that'll pay off later.
What makes it interesting and what makes it great script writing is the fact that they have so many interesting conversations throughout the movie between Bruce Willis and Gruber because of the walkie-talkie factor. This movie just plays so much better because it brings that humor by the culture clash of the two characters.
Well, the humor is an important factor. John McClane's sense of humor must have felt unique in the age of Schwarzenegger. That was really what made Die Hard special, was
his
ability to turn a phrase.
Bruce Willis a giant star. That's what related it to me so much. Any regular person, or I know if I was in that situation, I would probably be doing the same thing. I would just be like, oh, fuck, I gotta jump off this building. Fuck, why am I doing this? Shit. Okay, here we go. Jump off the building.
Oh, John, what the fuck are you doing? How the fuck did you get into this shit?
The movie takes its time to make some of these supporting characters filled out enough so that you care about them a little bit.
I wouldn't say that.
What?
I wouldn't say it fills out characters. I mean, a lot of people are generic stereotypes.
They give them one specific identifying characteristic.
Basically what a stereotype is.
No, not necessarily. What I'm saying is, like, take for example, in the terrorist team, there's a pair of blonde German brothers. One of them gets dispatched at the beginning of the film, and then that gives the second one a motivation to kill John McClane besides the fact that he's an antagonist to the terrorist plot. Like, now it's personal. They bother to take the extra time in the first act to set up those relationships to pay off as it goes along. And of course, Alan Rickman might be the great action movie foil of all time. He's on any short list. That's a star-making performance right there.
It's
right?
Got that great class divide. And to me, I mean, as fucked up as it is, it's kind of like the American dream. He's just going out shooting bad foreigners to get his fucking wife back.
Yeah. Every blue-collar American would love to take a snooty European down a peg. And here's a movie you get to do that. So at the center of the whole exercise really is the sturdy character of John McClane. What is it that makes John McClane so interesting?
You know, I think the start is how they made everyone else in the movie less interesting. John McClane's the only one that really knows what he's doing. Really one of the only likable characters in the entire movie, you know? The cops come in and instantly fuck everything up. Same thing with the FBI. The guy that's trying to take his wife is the biggest asshole known to man.
Hans! Bobby!
He tries to, like, take her on a fuck weekend over Christmas when her kids are waiting for her at home.
I'm thinking some mulled wine, a slice of brie.
You know, when Bruce Willis meets her for the first time, he's snorting coke off her desk. It's everybody. There's the news media who comes off as complete scumbags. There's even that interview when they talk to some guy who wrote a book on what it's like to be in a hostage situation, and then they cut back to the hostage situation, and he's totally wrong about what he's saying. Mm-hmm. So it's everybody's completely wrong, except for John McClane.
Not only are they wrong, but they also kind of like have their head up their ass about it, right? There's a whole social cast in the film that's even lower than the villains. Hans Gruber is more likable than the FBI and the police, and John McClane and his wife are above him.
He's the first real everyman blue-collar action hero. He's the blue-collar guy, the dumb American fighting the white-collar system.
Well, it's not only that, but it's almost like this whole environment is trying to take John McClane's wife away from him. His wife clearly is a more level-headed character than everyone around her, has chased the money and is now immersed in a lifestyle that has no room for John McClane, and John McClane has to take back what's his. You know, he has to prove that he's worthy of his wife's love. He's got to demonstrate why he's a worthy mate. my film theory teacher always broke it down to sex, that she was a sexual trophy that he had to prove his worth to be able to attain. And it's a little bit more complicated than that, because there's that interpersonal level of it. She's not just a sex object. She's also the most enigmatic and interesting person in the office. She seems like a woman that deserves a good man. Because it starts off with a marriage on the rocks. Holly uses her maiden name at the beginning of the movie, and then after John McClane has saved the day, she takes the name McClane.
Alan's my wife, Holly. Holly Gennaro.
Holly McClane.
It validates and glorifies in the violence that the hero is able to enact on his environment. It's about proving yourself as a man. And John McClane is forced to demonstrate his virtue. And the way he does that is by being a man of action. He's able to think on his feet. He's able to act decisively. And he's able to go up against these people that seem like serious threats. The movie is so economical in building up its suspense and then paying it off. And it's something that the best action movies, it's their stock and trade. It uses violence to make you fall in love with the hero. When John McClane dispatches one of the bad guys, it's a moment to cheer. I didn't see Die Hard in the movie theater, but I imagine that when Hans Gruber falls out of the window, it would have been one of the occasions where the audience got up and clapped. And they do that by building up suspense in anticipation of violence, and then they gratify you by exploding red across the screen. And the release works the same way as narrative gratification, except in action movies, it almost always boils down to violence.
So all you got to do to save your marriage is shoot 12 people in the face?
Well, that's sort of what Hollywood action movies would lead you to believe, right? I mean, that's what's proven again and again and again.
Just another American who saw too many movies as a child. Another orphan of a bankrupt culture who thinks he's John Wayne, Rambo, Marshall Dillon.
I was always kind of partial to Roy Rogers, actually. I really like those sequined shirts.
Now it's time for the Real Radar survey question. I think we have a pretty good one today. Our question is, do you think violent movies contribute to a violent culture? Yes or no? We also definitely want to hear some feedback on this. If you have the time, write in an email or send us a voicemail and tell us why you think yes or no to this question. Justin, do you think violent movies contribute to a violent culture?
I mean, nowadays, I guess that's a hard question with all the crazy shootings and stuff like that. But I'm still going to have to go with no, because I think, you know, movies should test our morals and our balance, and the movies are a safe place to do that.
Well, that's definitely like an argument that Tarantino and Pauline Kael have made throughout the years, it's a place where you can live out a fantasy that you wouldn't participate in
exactly,
in real life.
Exactly, movies,
right?
Or video games, you know, you wouldn't do that in real life.
I would definitely say that the short answer is yes, they definitely contribute to a violent culture, but the bottom line is it's not the major contributing factor to a violent culture. It's not because of movies that people are violent. It might move the needle, but there's probably more important things that define whether somebody's going to become violent or not. I don't think that we should stop making violent movies. Obviously, violent movies are a part of our culture, but I think it would be unfair and maybe a little bit of an easy answer to say that they don't contribute. They probably do contribute, but that's just a vice that we have to deal with.
What also makes you wonder if you took all the violence out of art,
would
all that pent-up rage just make people do the same things anyway?
Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe the most important question to ask is, like, if you look back at the time in American history where movies weren't violent, you know, where people were releasing Singing in the Rain and you couldn't have somebody receive a bullet and fire a bullet in the same shot, like, is that a less violent world than the one we live in now? I don't really have the statistics to back this up, but I think we're living in a less violent world now than we did in the 40s or something like that. You know, it's not because movies became violent. It's because people are more educated and have access to more opportunities to learn about why violence is bad. So, I don't know. It's a tough question. I'm definitely interested in what you have to say on this matter. You can visit realradar.com and vote on the survey. You can leave an email at feedback@realradar.com, or you can leave us a voicemail at 323-RADAR-47. That's 323-723-2747. And we will report back with your votes on an upcoming podcast.
But I know why you're here.
Why?
Could it be because there's no place else to hide?
I'm here because you once said you thought we could be happier here. Remember?
I'm sorry.
time to start talking about straw dogs?
It's time to get grim in this.
Let's talk some motherfucking straw dogs.
You know, one thing we ought to say is me and Scott saw this movie for the first time together, right?
Pretty shortly after we met. Like, we'd only known each other for like a couple months.
We were in college. We're in a dorm room. And I just remember people kept coming into my room. Maybe like 10 people came in. And by the end of this movie, we were the only two left.
And I remember I went home after that and felt like shit. Straw Dogs is the story of the Sumner family, made up of David Sumner, played by Dustin Hoffman, and Amy Sumner, played by Susan George. It's suggested that David is dodging the draft and has come out to an idyllic town in England to finish writing his book on mathematics. And he's a nebbish kind of guy who doesn't take control of situations. And this town seems to be full of loudish drunks who take advantage of him and covet his beautiful wife. And this nebbish character is pushed to the brink. We have to ask ourselves when we get into the violence of whether this makes Dustin Hoffman heroic or not. Or is it better to be a coward, or is it better to be a man of action? I mean, it's famous for a bunch of reasons. It came out in 71. It's the same year that A Clockwork Orange came out. It's sort of been lumped together with Clockwork Orange because both of those films were banned for years in England. It was ultimately given an X rating and had to be trimmed down a little bit, which I think also happened to A Clockwork Orange. It's definitely a movie where you get to ask yourself, do you agree with Sam Peckinpah or do you not? Is he using cinema to perpetrate a lie, or is he illustrating something that's real and important about masculinity and sexuality?
No, but I don't think it's a movie you have to watch with Peckinpah's viewpoint in mind. It's more instinctual. I don't even know if I really picked up that Dustin Hoffman destroyed his marriage the first time I watched it. But you get that instinctual feeling of destruction.
I'm pretty sure that Sam Peckinpah is on the record saying that Dustin Hoffman's character of David is the real villain of the movie. That David, almost every occasion in this film, is making the wrong choice. He misses a bunch of basic social cues in the first half of the film, and then when it ultimately explodes into violence in the last half hour, if he had a better control, not necessarily of his manhood, but of his ability to communicate, he would have been able to turn the situations to a more favorable outcome. It's a slow burn kind of a movie.
The whole first half of this movie is meant to emasculate Dustin Hoffman's character. From the very first scene, everybody in town is leering at his wife.
Maybe the second or third shot is a close-up of Susan George's nipples.
It's like the fucking beginning of Effort Fake, for Christ's sake.
It's not like it's lost on him, and he loathes himself for not taking advantage of these situations where he doesn't get to assert his manhood, that he takes out his anger on his wife. Okay, so there's a rape. It's a brutally demonstrated rape. It's part of the reason why people are still talking about Straw Dogs today. And it's got to stack amongst the top 10 most controversial scenes.
These guys are working on Dustin Hoffman's house, and they know Susan George because she grew up in the town. So one day, they're like, yeah, let's all go out hunting. They take him out hunting, put him in the woods somewhere, while they go back to his house and rape his wife. The first person to rape her is the guy she may or may not have been involved with back in the day when she was a kid. Halfway through the rape scene, I don't know if she looks like she's enjoying it or she's at least trying to stop further violence by just letting it happen and get it over with.
She certainly puts on a face of enjoying the sexual experience. It's definitely the part that makes you ask how you're supposed to feel about this. And there's two interpretations. You could interpret that Susan George is using a submissive positioning of herself in the scene to limit the violence that could be inflicted upon her. That if she puts on a face of enjoying it, then he won't feel the need to express anger through more violence. And the other way you could look at it is that she's so frustrated by her nebbish husband that when she finally gets involved in a sexual experience with a man who's able to take control of a situation, she surprised herself in that she likes it. And that's an extremely troubling implication with this sequence. And it's not unjustified for people to come to this conclusion, because just about every woman that's in this film is sexually objectified.
She does have a character. She has plenty of nice scenes with Dustin Hoffman where she's fucking with him. There's room to play there. Like, I cared about her enough as a character for that to hollow through those scenes.
Okay. I think think that you could definitely see that. Some of the scenes with Dustin Hoffman, she isn't specifically just being a sex object. But a lot of times when she's not being a sex object, she's being a emasculating woman. I think that both of the perspectives have value. You know, it would be whitewashing sexuality a little bit to say that there isn't excitement that can be derived from somebody taking control of a situation. And you could understand as a character that she would take on a submissive position and pretend to enjoy it to protect herself. I think that where it becomes a little bit troubling is that since she's always sexualized and she's always presented as a sex object in just about every scene in the movie, you don't get to see Susan George's character from enough of a three-dimensional perspective to see Peckinpah being interested in anything but her sexuality. So if she's just a sex object, then seeing her enjoy it makes it easier for an audience to come to the conclusion that we're supposed to enjoy it.
I don't think it's that. I think it's the fact that there is no decision. To me, it looks like it's shot from three perspectives. Her perspective as a victim, then there's shots of him looking down at her as if you were the rapist, and then there's a god's eye view, Peckinpah's point of view, basically, of the action taking place, which would include the pain shots and slow-mo and stuff like that. Peckinpah is known for his slow-mo and people getting shot in slow-mo, but here, you don't see the slow motion of her getting hit. The slow-mo isn't on the action, it's on the pain, her reacting to the pain, which brings you into her perspective as a character. Three perspectives, and you're meant to choose one. And I think the audience can't fucking deal with that. Because usually a rape scene is so black and white, you know? This is bad. Where now it's just like, this is happening. What do you think it means?
One other thing that's worth noting about the rape scene is that the trim that occurred to get it its R rating on its initial release. Okay, so she gets raped by Charlie, and then another guy shows up and proceeds to rape her again. That was the part that was cut out, because in a lot of ways it's the most brutal and unpleasant part of the sequence. But it's also, if you cut the scene when she's enjoying it and doesn't return back to the horror, then you're led to feel that the point of the scene was that she was enjoying the rape. I think that the trim in a lot of ways really added to some of the furor that surrounded the film upon its initial release.
To come to his defense a little bit, then two scenes later they go to the church, and that is very much played like a victim of rape's perspective. You know, she's got to be in this place with everybody in town, including the guys that raped her, laughing and partying, and all you get is flashbacks to the rape scene. You know, fragmented images, which does seem like memory, and at the same time, it amazes you how much it affects you as an audience member.
Yeah, you're not going to be allowed to forget it. One of my favorite little cuts in that sequence, there's a shot where the vicar, where the priest, just leans into the frame the same way you saw one of the rapists lean in during the rape scene, and it's going to show now how any man is a potential threat to her, how that is going to shape and color her perception of this town and every man around her going forward.
Well, I mean, that's another thing I find beautiful about this movie, is it's not just our classic director with a known bag of tricks pulling them out constantly. Like, he literally doesn't use any slow-mo or fast editing until you reach the rape scene.
Oh, but when he brings it, though, Jesus Louises, it is so unsettling. And, you know, when we were talking earlier about Die Hard, how Hollywood action movies make violence fun, creating entertainment out of violence, the violence in Straw Dogs is so thoroughly unpleasant.
Watching someone get shot in the foot is worse than watching someone get hung or shot several times in Die Hard. It's so painful to watch. Mm-hmm. You're just like, oh my God, he got shot in the foot.
And there's just so much tension. Peckinpah is staging the action so that you don't know where the next rock is going to come through the window. But then at other moments when they're trying to get into the house, you know how he has to get from over here to over there.
Unlike Die Hard, where to make it work, you need to make the geography clear. Here, to ratchet up the tension, he needs to make it foggy.
It's actually foggy in this thing. You're talking about unclear. Like you
Yes. Yes. The attackers are coming from different directions, and they're trapped in a house, and their windows are slowly getting broken out to more and more vulnerable, so it ratchets up that tension of the unknown.
You know what ratchets up tension? Not only are they seriously scary, but they're also drunk and having fun, and they're riding around on like a tricycle that they find.
Oh, I
and
love
the,
that.
The tricycle has the goofiest little like horn on it. and it's the most unsettling sound because it catches you off guard every time it happens.
I love the scene of the one guy's all drunk and he's riding by, and the other guy's like, fuck you, we gotta do this, get off that tricycle, and you see him chase him around a corner.
He goes out of frame.
And then they both come back, both on tricycles, like racing. But what seems so crazy to me, too, is they have that whole scene. These guys that raped her are now in her house confronting her about this guy that they want to kill because he's a rapist. The irony is painful. And the fact that she wants to give in to them right after the rape scene, when he comes home from hunting, she never tells Dustin Hoffman, her husband, that she's been raped. And one of the things she says is, we're both cowards.
You're a coward.
Oh,
no.
And
I'm a coward. Plain and simple.
Like, she'll put up the fight, but then she'll always give in. She gave in that rape scene and feels guilty about it. And she only stops wanting to give in when Dustin Hoffman's like, they just killed a cop. If they get in here, we're all dead.
You almost feel like Dustin Hoffman has been itching for it to come to this all along. He's so satisfied to finally take on the role of, this is my house.
I will not allow violence against this house.
He's crossed that line, and he's even yelling at his wife at that point. He even slaps her at one point.
You'll stay there and do as you're told. If you don't, I'll break your neck.
He's finally trying to kill that emasculated part of himself, and he's trying to become that man of action that he's wanted to be the entire time. And the point of it is that he takes it too far.
He thrives off that aggression, which destroys his marriage.
Well, that's the whole thing. In Die Hard, all of this violence ultimately mends the marriage. It's obvious that Peckinpah is fascinated by violence because it comes up again and again, and he lavishes so much stylistic attention on it that you kind of get the feeling that maybe he gets off on violence the same way that Tarantino does.
Well, okay.
But he's clearly making an argument that violence is a destructive force in Straw Dogs, that it should have been handled differently.
At the end, Dustin Hoffman leaves his wife there with a house full of corpses. This is what comes of male aggression. You're in a house full of corpses and your marriage is destroyed.
It's not quite as simple as that.
Because
satisfying cinematically to watch him finally pay off all that tension that had been building up over the course of the film. You know, people have called Straw Dogs a fascist film that justifies vigilante justice. And the reason why people can come to that conclusion is because it's so exciting for him to be able to punish these people who have been punishing him for the whole film.
Peckinpah violence makes you think. It's not like Die Hard. Once somebody's dead, you completely throw it away. But in Peckinpah violence, the images stay with you. So you remember that piece of tiny slow motion. I think even in Cross of Iron, some of the slow motion isn't them shooting. It's them, like, ejecting a clip. And that's kind of some of the stuff I remember more than the actual death scene.
And he also is morally ambivalent about it. He's not one of those filmmakers that are saying violence is universally awful.
Well, that's not like,
true. He's saying that it's a part of life.
I think ambivalent's a bad word for it. He's known for saying the slow motion death scene in The Wild Bunch was supposed to be horrific, and it was supposed to turn you away.
Yeah, but that's a cop out. Come on, like, he must have known he had something else on his hands.
Yeah, well, I mean, it turns into being such a beautiful image that it changed fucking cinematic history for all time. But I think he changed the way he used slow motion to where we are in Straw Dogs, where you see the pain, and it's not about the action. He didn't want to glorify the violence.
But the end of Straw Dogs is action.
I'm talking about the slow motion
sequences.
Like, slow motion. You see people die in slow motion in The Wild Bunch, which glorifies death. Here you see pain. When the old man gets shot in the foot at the end trying to claw through the window, you don't see the shot. You don't see him pulling the trigger. You just see his fucking foot explode and him in pain in slow motion. So he's trying to leave you with the resonance of violence.
The repercussions of
the violence.
Yeah,
exactly.
What do you make of the last scene of it? I gotta say, when he's driving away with the simpleton and they have like a little exchange, I don't know the way home, neither do I. What did you ever make of that? I feel like that's not the greatest ending of the world.
For me, I think it's Dustin Hoffman has traversed so far past anything that was his past self that he doesn't know where he's going on from here. It could be without his wife, but at this point, he's reached some new stage in his life where he doesn't care.
If nothing else, I think it's sort of effective in diffusing the vigilante justice argument, that it's not showing him in chest-thumping mode anymore, that he doesn't know how to process what he's just been through, which is certainly in line with the audience. In a lot of ways, Straw Dogs sort of works as a litmus test of the viewer. Like, you could watch it and say, man, that was a badass ending. Or you could watch it and say, that was the most horrifying thing
I've
ever seen.
But in perspective, Dustin Hoffman basically does the right thing. You know, you figure, you hit a guy with your car, all he wants to do is wait for the fucking doctor to show up, and then these guys kill the fucking local cop outside his door. So at that point, he has to either kill or be killed.
Yeah, but I'm gonna fight you a little bit on this, because I think that...
This isn't an argument, because if Susan George wanted to give him up, you would just watch them kill this guy in their front yard.
But he could have also taken his wife and taken this guy and put him in the car and saying, we're getting the fuck out of here. In his posturing throughout the whole film, you have to acknowledge that his position is to antagonize them. Just in little things like the fact that he's looking for only American cigarettes and the way that he fires them. That's it, and I've taken out the money that you wasted here. He's doing it in a way that makes them hate him as much as possible.
Well, I think he did it in a way because he's the biggest pussy possible.
Yeah, but I think what Peckinpah is saying in this film is the fact that he's a pussy is part of the problem. That if he had handled some of those other situations building up to the movie...
That's the whole point. That's the point of Susan George saying we're both cowards. If he would have stepped to those guys and been like, yo, I don't like the way you're fucking looking at my wife, then none of this shit might have happened at all.
Yeah, and that's a tricky thing to deal with because we're almost always sympathetic to the nerd in a movie. For Peckinpah to take a very cautious and critical view of his actions from the first scenes in the movie is an important part of understanding that guy's character, because every time he gets emasculated, you could see how he takes it out on his wife and the way he takes it out on himself, and in a way that's destructive and leads to the violence at the end. It's in those moments he's not taking responsibility for himself as a person who's occupying a house, who's responsible for Susan George the same way as Susan George is responsible for him. He's not pulling his weight as a contributor to this relationship. Peckinpah is exploring how there's homicidal violence when violence gets out of control and becomes destructive. And then there's also aggressive territory claiming violence that would be able to defuse the argument.
If he was even just a little territorial in the beginning of the movie, then I think none of this probably would have happened.
Well, here we are. We're kind of proving out that we're fascists, I think, Justin. At the end of the day, it gets a bad rap because it's a movie that's more about the male gaze than it is about women. And the combination of all the sexualization of Susan George combined with the complete sexualization of the teenager, the Janice Hedden character who ultimately gets killed by the simpleton.
Yeah, she really has no
so
other character.
So consistent that it's off-putting, and ultimately that they had given the women a little bit more of a role to play in this film. It could have explored these concepts of violence and territoriality without all of this icky implication about sexuality. If you looked at it from a certain perspective, you could say to yourself that Peckinpah is arguing not so much that he's saying that this character versus this person that she knows could find a certain amount of pleasure from this specific rape. Since there's so much sexualization of the women, you can very easily look at it like Peckinpah is saying that there is pleasure to be found from rape, and there plainly isn't always going to be pleasure found from rape.
I think you need to go the opposite. If you move the rape scene forward in the film, if you had a couple more scenes where she had to keep it from him, and then you go into the violence at the end, then I think you would have had a little more space to breathe. Because really where you connect with her character is the pain in the rape scene and the pain of the church social afterwards. All the leers in the beginning of the movie and the sexualization of her are seen as violence against her.
Well, the male gaze, yes, of course.
You know, I mean, there's that scene where they're all fixing the barn or whatever the fuck outside, and her nylons are torn, and she pulls her skirt up to fix it, and you can see her panties, and they're all staring at her. She is constantly being violated by people around her, and she just runs in the house. And it's another scene where Dustin Hoffman doesn't do anything. Then she has a little talk with Dustin Hoffman, goes upstairs and strips, and then they can see her naked from inside the window, and she's just kind of standing there.
I think it's Peckinpah in those situations saying that she's using her sexuality to control the men. Here's something that I have that you can't have, that it belongs inside this house and it's not going to get outside. I want you to see it and see what you can't have. And that's like a power dynamic that's in place. But at the same time, you could look at the scene and say that Peckinpah is showing her, putting these guys in a situation where they have to rape her, and then she gets what she deserves. You could definitely read these moments and come to that conclusion, and it's not like it's out of the clear blue. Now, like, if you dig into it and get a little bit more nuanced about it, sure, you can see some of Peckinpah's arguments here, but you're playing with fire at these kinds of moments, and you have to be very specific when you're using this kind of imagery, as I think.
I don't know, but at the same time, this movie's a fucking masterpiece, and, you know, what would be art if you didn't play with fire every once in a while?
Hear, hear.
I don't know my way home.
It's okay. I don't either.
The Real Radar podcast is produced by myself, Scott Sipu. It's hosted by me and Justin Rodriguez.
Yeah.
It's edited by the two of us together. The theme song is written and performed by Kevin Nicholas, and we'd like to offer a special thanks to Katie Carmen Lehack. On the next episode, we are going to be reviewing Ingmar Bergman's Silence of God trilogy,
which includes Through a Glass Darkly, Winterlight, and The Silence, some of the most depressing movies I've seen in a while. So catch up on these, because we're going to be spoiling these in the next episode.
Please like us on Facebook at facebook.com/realradar and visit realradar.com, where you can download every episode of the podcast, participate in our surveys, check out essays and slideshows and all kinds of fun stuff. I hope you enjoyed the show today, and we'll see you next time.
Rivet in, y'all.